welcome to Queer Crime, episode number 29. I'm your host, Patrick. As always, I wanted to remind you, my faithful, engaging, committed, and gorgeous queer crimers around the world, that Queer Crime is now on Patreon. As you will appreciate from every other independent podcast that you listen to, creating a podcast is time-consuming, and it costs a fair bit of money, not just because of the hosting platforms and the recording equipment, but also because of the amount of wine I have to drink to get through each episode. Of course, that leads me on to welcome my first two patrons, Katie Kirby from Houston in Texas and Pete from London in the United Kingdom. Absolutely outstanding. I can't thank you enough. I've been having some good email chats with Katie. I love finding out more about listeners, especially a queer crime queen like Katie. She's a proper flag flyer. She's awesome, and she suggested a superb future episode of Queer Crime. Thank you, Katie. And Pete in London, you're awesome too. Thanks for the photo of your puppy. He's beautiful. You brought a massive smile to my face. So to the rest of my listeners, my main episodes will always be free, and I will never expect anything more than your continued devotion to queer crime and insatiable thirst for these horrible stories. But if you want to provide some extra devotion and love, you know where to go. It's patreon.com/queercrime. When you're there, you'll see the different levels of support that you can provide and the additional benefits you'll get. For the price of a glass of mediocre wine in a run-of-the-mill restaurant, you'll get a shout-out on the show, early ad-free access to all future episodes, and a bonus episode each month, exclusive to patrons. And those benefits are just for starters. More benefits will be added in time, like mini-episodes, where I'll probably be a little bit more sweary. And of course, undying and everlasting gratitude from me. The first bonus episode is available to download and listen to now. It's an unknown and infuriating case from the 1950s in Rotherham in South Yorkshire. I definitely needed more wine after that one. If you want to hear more, or you want to step up from being a queer crimer to a queer crime queen like Katie and Pete, then head over to patreon.com/queercrime. That's patreon.com/queercrime. Advance warning. This episode contains descriptions of violent assaults, murders, mutilation, torture, bias, and prejudice. It's not for the faint-hearted. Listen at your own discretion. It's 1986. Best musical at the Tonys was The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Best comedy series at the Emmys was The Golden Girls. Song of the Year at the Grammys was We Are the World, sung by Michael Jackson and 45 other famous 1980s figures like Cyndi Lauper, Huey Lewis, Paul Simon, Steve Perry, and Kim Carnes. And Best Picture at the Oscars was Out of Africa. Sadomasochism is a particular kind of violence using pain or humiliation inflicted on another person, but with the purposes of sexual gratification or arousal. Usually sadomasochism is along the lines of the dominant person, who has some form of device such as a whip or other instrument, ordering the obedient person to submit to them fully. Simply by submitting to someone else, the dominant person has their desires fulfilled as the sex act begins. Coprophilia, on the other hand, is quite different, and in my eyes, quite disgusting. I often say that I'm not interested in kink-shaming anyone, but this one is totally what the fuck. Coprophilia is using human feces in any form of sexual way. During my research for this episode, which was pretty grim, I found that it is apparently more common than you think, but Jesus Christ, I can't get my head around it. The horrifying antagonist of this story was a beautiful, suave man with traffic-stopping good looks, but with a significant interest in both of these things, sadomasochism and coprophilia. The true depth of his interest in these areas would not be known until he was caught after his murder spree. Brace yourself for his story. The London borough of Kensington and Chelsea is the home of Harrods and is one of the nicest, poshest and most expensive areas of London to live in. And it was this beauty of the area that attracted many gay men to live there in the 1970s and 1980s. In fact, Kensington and Chelsea had a significant LGBT plus population in the early 1980s. The area was dotted with many gay bars such as the Colhern, the Lord Ranelagh and Harpies and Louies, and a gay nightclub, one of the first nightclubs in England specifically aimed at gay people, called the Copacabana. The London gay scene attracted gay men from all over the United Kingdom. In the years after homosexuality was decriminalised in England in 1967, men from cities, towns and villages in England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland, who wanted to be in the centre of the burgeoning gay scene, flocked there to find friends and to find love. There was something for everyone. People who wanted a long-term partner. People who wanted a string of one-night stands. People who were into drugs. People who were rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous. People who were looking for love. People who wanted sugar daddies. People who wanted to dress as flamboyantly and as full of expression as they wanted. People who were into S&M. People who were into leather. It was a never-ending party. There was always someone there to support you. You had friends. A sense of community. And then, as the 1980s progressed, the party became frightening. Gay men started getting sick. There was no explanation or no understanding of this illness. And then, gay men started dying. And an already marginalised section of society became even more isolated by the media, police and politicians. But despite this, the partying in the early to mid-1980s didn't stop. London continued to be a huge draw for young gay men around the country. Just as one crowd of young gay men grew older, wiser and more settled, another young group of gay men would take their place, keen to have the same wild experiences as the trailblazers before them. In amongst the upsetting and tragic deaths of gay men who were being struck down with a mystery and seemingly incurable illness, another tragedy was unfolding in London, a tragedy that was partly caused by the mystery illness which was killing gay men. On the 16th of March 1986, two homeless men went to one of their usual haunts to drink alcohol. It was the derelict basement of a large Edwardian terraced house in Warwick Road in Earl's Court. The homeless men had been there many times, and it provided shelter and safety for them at night after they would pass out drunk. The two men entered the lower entrance of the building into the basement, and they looked around the dark room. They immediately stopped in their tracks. In front of them was the half-naked and mutilated body of a young man. Feeling really uneasy that the killer might return, both of them left as quickly as they could, and went to the police station on the next road to report their discovery. When the police turned up, they looked at the man's ripped and torn clothing. It was pretty obvious to the police, based on what the man was wearing, that this was more than likely a gay man who was into the leather scene. But the markings on the body were the most disturbing element of this death. The man had savage scratch marks on his torso, almost like an animal had attacked him or clawed at him. His tongue had a chunk removed, as if it had been bitten off. He had bite marks all over his body, and it was assumed that he had been beaten using a spanner which had been found nearby. It was also evident that there were strangulation marks around the man's neck. Finally, from the revolting stench that punctured the air, they could tell that the man's face, mouth, chest and upper body was smeared in human feces. It was a vile and horrific scene, and the police felt sick thinking about how this man's body had been mutilated and the pain that he must have endured in his last moments alive. The police did a cursory look around the room, and they spotted something small on the other side. They sidled over to have a look at it. What was it, they thought. They drew nearer. It was covered in blood, so it must be connected to the case. And then it dawned on them. They drew back in revulsion. It was the missing part of the dead man's tongue. The police launched an investigation into the man's murder, and they immediately assumed it was a homophobic killing. But if the police thought that they were going to get any information from the gay community at the time, they were sadly mistaken. The police had spent years providing no support to the gay community when they had reported assaults and muggings, and they had spent years harassing the gay community in terms of the raids on gay men who were cottaging in public restrooms, and the gay community were extremely mistrustful when they had any dealings with the police. When they approached members of the gay community to identify this person, they were met with a wall of silence. Understandably, no one wanted to talk, but this type of killing did make the gay community fearful that there could be a madman on the loose. Eventually, and after experiencing much reluctance, the police managed to identify the gay man. His name was James Burns, a 36-year-old guy who was from Edinburgh in Scotland. He had moved to London a few years beforehand, and he was employed as a guard by British Rail. James was gay and loved drinking and socialising in the Coalhern pub, one of the most famous gay leather bars in London in the 1970s and 1980s. Coincidentally, the Coalhern pub is the same pub that the Gay Slayer used as his pickup joint 7 years later. I covered the Gay Slayer in episode 9 of Queer Crime, so if you haven't listened to that one, go back and check it out. The guy is a complete wanker. Obviously, wait until you finish this episode first though. The police established that James had been in the Coalhern on the night that he had died, but there was little other information about who he was with, who he had been speaking to, and who he had left with. It was a dead end, not simply because the gay community didn't trust the police and wouldn't help them, but simply because there wasn't any information available. It was all very mysterious. 3 weeks later, 5 miles away from where James's body was found, some children were playing near a railway line near Brixton, and they entered a derelict shed. Immediately after opening the door, they were confronted with a sight that no child should ever see. The half-naked, mutilated, and tortured body of a young man. The children screamed and ran from the building. They ran to the nearest phone and called the police. When the police arrived, they sealed off the area and looked at his body and the scene. Similar to the murder of James Burns, it was evident that this guy had been through absolute hell in his dying moments. He had been bitten all over. He had scratch marks all over his body. He had been beaten very badly, and his penis was half severed by his attacker, who had tried to bite it off. Finally, this man had been killed by being strangled with his own scarf. The police announced to the public that they had found a body, and they issued a description of what the man looked like. One man contacted the police to say that his flatmate hadn't returned home from a night out 2 days ago, and the description sounded similar. The man's flatmate went to the mortuary and formally identified the dead man as 26-year-old Anthony Connolly. Anthony had moved to London as a university student, and upon completion of his degree, he left London. But the draw of the capital city, as well as the wider range of employment opportunities, was too much for him, so he had returned to London recently to find work as a university lecturer. However, Anthony struggled to get the job of his dreams, and at the time of his death, he was unemployed. Anthony's flatmate confirmed to the police that Anthony was gay, and had a very active social life on the gay scene in London. The last time that Anthony was seen was 2 days earlier in a gay pub in Brixton with one of his female friends. The last thing he said to his friend was that he was leaving the pub because he, quote, had just met the most beautiful man, end quote. But that was it. There was no other information. No one knew who this beautiful man was that he was referring to, and no one had seen Anthony leaving with him. At this point, two young gay men had been found dead in London, found dead 3 weeks apart. However, despite the similarities between the murder of James Burns in Kensington and the murder of Anthony Connolly in Brixton, the deaths were not linked. London was divided into different police forces, and there was no shared computer system in the 1980s, so it wasn't easy to link murders, even if they had such obvious similarities. However, there was another issue that arose here, which slowed down investigations, an issue which is infuriating, as it highlights both prejudice and a significant lack of understanding. When Anthony's flatmate went to the mortuary to identify him, he told the mortuary staff that he was HIV positive. As a result of this, and because of the ignorance of the time about HIV and AIDS, no one was willing to perform a post-mortem on Anthony for over 2 weeks. The coroner simply had no assurances that they were not going to get infected with the disease if they performed an autopsy on Anthony. This delay in the post-mortem also meant that the police were delayed in getting more information about the cause of death, and a delay in making a connection between the two murders. Then 1 month later, on Thursday the 8th of May 1986, the killer struck again. But this time, the victim escaped. Thirty-year-old David Cole had been out drinking with friends at the Market Tavern pub near Covent Garden in London. As the night progressed, he saw a devastatingly handsome man standing up against the wall near the rear of the pub. Eventually, David worked up the courage to speak to him, and after a few moments of talking, they left together to walk towards the Covent Garden markets to have a quick sexual tryst in the darkness. When they arrived at the Covent Garden markets and they were in the throes of passion, David quickly started panicking when he realised that the gorgeous man that he had just met had put a ligature around his neck and had started choking him. David tried to fight him, but the man was too strong. He looked at the man's face, which had now changed from one of handsome beauty to maniacal red-faced horror. David continued to fight, but he felt it was a losing battle, and he had resigned himself to a certain fate when somehow he managed to work his fingers between the ligature and his neck. It was enough to give him some temporary respite from being strangled, and he regained some focus and resolve to fight for his life. Using all of his remaining energy, David pushed the man away from him, and the man abandoned his quest to kill David and he disappeared quickly into the night. David, gasping for air in a state of shock and horror, struggled to his feet and ricocheted towards his house. As he neared his home, he realized that he was still holding on to the ligature that he had been strangled with. He looked at the item. Rather innocuously, it was just a silk sock. He couldn't believe how something so dainty and pretty could be turned into something so dangerous and nearly take his life away from him. After convalescing for a few days and replaying the chilling moments of his encounter, David recalled reading news stories about the murders of James Burns and Anthony Connolly over the course of the previous weeks. A harrowing thought crept into David's mind. He might have met their killer. He could have been the third victim if he hadn't escaped. He agonized over what to do. Should he phone the police? Would they believe him, or would they think he was a crank? Surely not. His neck had serious bruising on it from when he was being strangled. But would they believe him? Could he trust them? Despite all of his internal dialogue, he decided to be brave. He phoned the police. The police who were investigating Anthony's murder took notice of David's story, and the lead investigator could sense that David was hesitant. He managed to provide assurance to David that his report would be taken seriously, and that they were pleased that a member of the gay community was finally speaking with the police. Feeling comforted by how sensitively the lead investigator was being towards him, David told him his story. Based on what David told him, the lead investigator knew that there was little chance of catching this killer unless he fucked up in some way, or if his bloodlust had been satisfied and he stopped, or if they caught him in the act. All of these possibilities were extremely remote, so the investigator realized that the most sensible approach would be to infiltrate the gay scene. This plan was flawed, though. Gay men were mistrustful of police. They were never going to help them. So the investigator proposed a plan to David. He asked him to find the courage to restart his social life again by going out to gay bars. And not only that, but to go to as many gay bars as possible in order to see if he could find the same man who had attacked him. David was reluctant to be involved as an undercover operative for the police, who, to be honest, he still didn't completely trust. Furthermore, David didn't have any undercover training. The investigator again reassured him that he didn't need any training. He only needed to go to gay bars, pretend he was walking around looking to hook up or looking for friends, but secretly, constantly, looking out for his attacker. David wasn't sure. He still didn't feel capable of doing this. But he realized that more and more members of the gay community would die if the killer was left to continue unchecked. However, what about David's safety? How would he know he wouldn't be assaulted again? The lead investigator told David that his safety was of paramount importance. Four plainclothes police officers would always be following David. They would always follow him into whatever pub he went into. They would provide him with whatever protection he needed if he came face to face with his attacker. Upon hearing this, David started to feel comfortable with the plan, and he agreed. Exactly 1 week later, the undercover operation began. David and the team of four male police officers in plain clothes who were following him from behind moved from one gay pub to the next gay pub to the next gay pub, spending between 30 to 45 minutes in each of them. Eventually, after exhausting the most popular gay bars, they made their way to a gay nightclub called Heaven, but again, the man who attacked David could not be found. David and the team of undercover police officers decided that, as it was late, they would go to one more pub. It was the pub that Anthony Connolly, the second murder victim, had last been seen in. When they arrived at the busy and noisy pub, David went through the usual rigmarole of walking around and scanning the faces of the crowd. To anyone who was in the pub, it simply looked like David was walking around looking for his friends, or people that he knew. Then suddenly, he spotted his attacker. He was leaning against a wall, looking leeringly at the men who were milling around the venue. David bravely approached him to talk to him. In David's mind, he wanted to confirm that this was definitely him. He needed to hear his voice. After a brief exchange, David left the handsome man standing at the wall and went back to the officers. After a few brief moments observing him, they swooped in, grabbed him by the arms, and led him out of the pub. The man looked confused, but he confirmed to the police, in a foreign accent, that his name was Michael Lupo. He was put in a police car and he was taken to the police station. At the station, David formally identified Michael as the man who had attacked him and tried to kill him. But Michael denied ever having met David. Michael started off quite strong with his denials, In fact, he looked suitably confused and concerned about why he was arrested in the first place. But he couldn't keep up the act for very long, and within a matter of an hour, Michael gave up his charade and he started confessing. But the confession was far creepier and more disturbing than anyone had expected. Michael started off by confessing to the attack on David Cole, and then, unprompted, he confessed to murdering James Burns and Anthony Connolly. But he wasn't finished. He also confessed to two more murders. This was becoming a much bigger murder investigation than the police had originally anticipated. But who were these other two murder victims? The first one was an unidentified homeless man who the police were aware of, but Michael's nonchalant, indifferent telling of the story made it considerably more frightening. Michael told the police that he had left the nightclub one night, and as he was walking home to his apartment, he was approached by the homeless man who was looking for a cigarette. Michael said he inexplicably exploded in anger and he kicked the man in the groin. When the man fell to the ground, Michael strangled him to death using just his bare hands. When the homeless man died, he threw his dead body into the River Thames. Michael continued with his journey home. The police had become aware of this death when the homeless man's body washed up further down the river. But the tragic part of this story is that the killing wasn't actively looked into, because it was doubtful that a homeless man's killer would ever be found. The homeless man was not identified. Still to this day, he remains unidentified. He has no name. How upsetting that this man was someone's son, and possibly a brother, an uncle, and maybe even a dad, and he was never missed. It's so depressing. As I said, the police were aware of this death, but they didn't put much effort into it given its circumstances. However, the police were not aware of the other murder that Michael had been referring to. Michael gave the police the location of the basement of the house where he had left the body. It was the body of a young Irishman called Damien McCluskey. Damien had suffered the same fate as James and Anthony, a brutal, savage, violent, violating, torturous murder at the hands of Michael. At the end of his confession, Michael was remanded in custody while the police looked into his life a little bit more. The first port of call was Michael's apartment in Earl's Court. They found amongst his possessions loads of leather clothing, whips, chains, harnesses, pornographic photos, and multiple instruments of torture. They also found his designer clothing, silk underwear and silk socks, and expensive furniture which, to the police, seemed in direct contrast to the hardcore S&M items that they had found elsewhere. Then they found an address book which contained hundreds and hundreds of address details of many rich and famous people all over the world. The police were shocked. Michael appeared to be well connected amongst influential people, even royalty. They had to tread carefully as they were unsure if this would become an international scandal. Or worse, given Michael's connections, they could easily get him off the hook. It soon transpired, though, that Michael was just fangirling all over these people. He'd never actually met any of them. Rather pathetically, it was just a case that he used to get their addresses and put them in his address book, so he could boast to people about how he was well connected and how he mixed with the great and beautiful of the world. Needy prick. Who on earth does that? Who on earth would pretend to know famous people? They're just ordinary people who have been thrust into the limelight because of the talent and achievements, or in many cases, thrust into the limelight despite having no talent or achievements. Either way, it appeared mixing with celebrities is a lifestyle that Michael wanted, rather than a lifestyle he had. As the police investigation continued, they discovered his appointment diary with coded names, and with the discovery of his appointment book, it soon became clear how Michael was making his money to pay for his designer clothing and his expensive furniture for his nice apartment in a posh part of London. He had created an alter ego called Rudy, who was a rent boy. It was evident from his appointment book that he was good at what he did. Michael had many clients who were into S&M, and they were willing to pay handsomely for his services. But who was Michael Lupo? Well, the police knew that he was Italian, and they knew that he was 33 years old. They knew that he had come to London 12 years earlier in 1974, and had carved out a successful life for himself. But they started to take steps even further back in his history in order to build a picture of this psycho. Michael was born on the 19th of January 1953 in Bologna in northern Italy. After an unremarkable Catholic upbringing, where he was an obedient child who performed in the local church choir, he was conscripted into the Italian army in 1971, where he was, again, obedient. From the outset, he demonstrated that he was a fast learner and an upstanding soldier, so much so that he was invited to join an elite commando unit within the army. There, he learned many skills, including how to be a leader, how to perform under pressure, and how to kill someone using your bare hands. Useful skill. Michael knew he was gay from an early age, but he kept it hidden from his family because of his Catholic upbringing, and also because of the views of the Italian military. However, he couldn't keep his sexual orientation under wraps forever, and he wanted to explore this side of himself, so he left the army, left Italy, and he emigrated to England for a new life. Of course, as soon as he arrived in London, he instantly became a hit on the gay scene. He was a beautiful Italian man, had an amazing physique from his army training, had the most captivating smile, and was charm and charisma personified. People looked at him wherever he went, and he knew it. He loved being the centre of attention. His extraordinary good looks and beautiful accent ensured that he got a job really quickly in one of the stores of the luxury brand Yves Saint Laurent. After a while of working in this shop and meeting its rich clientele, he realised that women from the West End of London spent huge amounts of money on their hair, so he retrained as a hairstylist while holding down his full-time job at the posh clothing store. Quite quickly he demonstrated that he was a talented hairstylist, so he left his job at Yves Saint Laurent and he used his talent and charm to get a job at a top salon in London. There, because of his natural charisma, beauty and talent, he earned so much in tips that his tips were often higher than his weekly wage. Of course, it wasn't all work, work, work. Michael had an extremely active sex life with as many men as he could. He had his pick of the men everywhere he went. With his exposure to an ever-growing number of men, he came into contact with men with various sexual appetites and vastly different sexual desires. The overriding sexual desire that he found himself immersed in and drawn to was S&M. But this wasn't commonplace. It wasn't as easy to find then as it is now on the internet, so people would pay good money to be tortured, abused, or humiliated. It occurred to Michael that he could make money from his many sexual encounters by placing a personal ad for S&M and bondage. It was around this time that he created an alter ego called Rudy, and this started another very lucrative revenue stream for him. In fact, he became so good at this S&M job that he had clients in Paris and New York who would fly him out to perform his insatiable style of torture on them. His desire for S&M started spilling into his personal choice of everyday clothing, and he started wearing leather jackets or leather pants. He became well known and popular amongst all of the leather gay bars in London, as he continued to be handsome and charming, even if he was becoming a bit of an attention-seeking exhibitionist. However, Michael's interest in S&M wasn't just about earning him money. It gave him sexual gratification, but he needed increasingly heightened experiences to gain the same level of pleasure. He started to develop a growing interest in violent sex, because after a few years of having clients who exposed him to all manner of sexual activity, humiliation, abuse, pain, torture, whipping, handcuffs, and so on, this no longer satisfied him. By his own estimation, he had had sex in the 12 years since he had moved to London with around 3,000 men, and he had accepted that the sex he was used to was simply losing its magic. He needed something more to get turned on. Instead of inflicting pain on people, he started to become sexually attracted to and aroused by mutilation. In early 1986, the year of his arrest, Michael found out that he was HIV positive, and he was absolutely livid. Michael viewed this as a death sentence. He was furious because he thought of himself as being too handsome, too popular, and had too much going for him to just die. His HIV diagnosis triggered something in him. He became reckless. He continued having unprotected sex with as many men as possible, and he never told his sexual partners that he had HIV. But this didn't help him. Michael was still furious, and he was fit to kill. So he did just that. On the 16th of March 1986, he went to the Colhern pub and he met James Burns. The rest of that horrible evening remains unknown, but we know the extent of James's injuries with scratches all over his torso, bite marks all over his body, half his tongue bitten off and spat across the room, feces smeared all over his face and body, before he was strangled to death. Michael left James lying dead in the basement of the derelict house, and James was discovered by two homeless men a short while later. 3 weeks later, Michael killed Anthony Connolly in a similarly horrible manner, and left his mutilated body to be found by children. 2 weeks later, he strangled an elderly homeless man using his bare hands. The homeless man's crime? Simply asking Michael for a cigarette. A week later, Michael was in a gay club and he met a 24-year-old Irish guy called Damien McCluskey. Michael took him to the basement of a derelict building, and Damien started giving Michael a blowjob. During the sex act, Michael started strangling Damien with a silk sock. When Damien was dead, Michael started biting Damien's body. When he was finished, he left the building, and Damien's body lay undiscovered for weeks until Michael told the police where to find it. The next attempt by Michael to kill someone was when he met David Cole. Thankfully, we know that David managed to escape, and it led to the undercover operation which caught Michael. Police were keen, as they always are, to know why. Why did he commit these crimes? Michael was quizzed about his motivations for killing and for attempting to kill, but he couldn't offer anything. The only thing that he said to investigators was that he wasn't sorry for any of his actions. He said that he didn't want to say sorry because he didn't mean it. Jesus. Despite Michael's lack of remorse and lack of empathy, he was confirmed by professionals not to be suffering any psychological issues, and he was declared fit for trial. He was simply bad, not mad. 13 months later, on the 10th of July 1987, Michael's trial started in the Old Bailey in London. Without question, he pleaded guilty to 4 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder. The prosecutor told the jury that Michael's, quote, urge to kill, with the exception of the tramp, was no more than a product of his sexual inclinations, which at the time of the killings gratified him and his sexual tastes. In short, he enjoyed it, end quote. The prosecutor also told the jury that the reason Michael had eventually turned to killing people was because that he was furious about being diagnosed with HIV. He said that Michael's diagnosis clouded his judgment and made him want to cause as much harm as he could to the gay community who had infected him with the disease. At the end of the court case, Michael was found guilty of all charges and sentenced to 4 life sentences for the murders and 14 for the attempted murders. Realizing that Michael was now suffering with AIDS, the judge said that he would not make a recommendation that Michael should spend a minimum period in prison and said, quote, life means life, end quote, noting that Michael already had the death sentence affecting his health. Michael was taken to prison in Durham, about 260 miles north of London. In prison, the other prisoners wouldn't share a cell with him, wouldn't speak to him, wouldn't even be in his vicinity because they were fearful that they would, quote, get AIDS from him, end quote. Don't you just love the madness and ignorance of the 1980s? Throughout his time in prison, Michael spent much of his time in and out of the prison hospital due to various health issues. 8 years after Michael's imprisonment, at the age of 43 years old, he died of AIDS on Sunday the 12th of February, 1995. It's hard to feel anything other than indifference about the death of an unsympathetic, narcissistic, egotistical, conceited, pretentious, murdering arsehole. I had 2 overriding but interconnected thoughts about this case. Firstly, we can't imagine how many people he would have killed if David Cole hadn't been brave enough to go undercover. Secondly, how many people did he knowingly infect with HIV and kill that way instead? Actually, do you know what? I was indifferent about his death, but those thoughts made me realise that I'm pleased he's dead. He's a fucking bollocks. Other than the horrible deaths of those poor men, the other chilling part of this story is that Michael bit his victims. He bit their bodies, their arms, their legs, their tongues, and their penises. There were scratch marks all over the bodies of the victims, as if like a crazed animal, like a rabid dog or a rabid wolf. Was this part of Michael's sexual desires? Were the bite marks and animalistic scratch marks part of his psyche? After all, this handsome Italian surname was Lupo. Lupo in Italian translates into English as wolf. Did you know that there are 195 countries in the world, and that out of those 195 countries, it's still illegal to be a gay man in 72 of them? Did you know it's still illegal to be a gay woman in 44 of them? And did you know that any same-sex activity in 11 of them could result in a death penalty? Utterly shameful in the year 2021. Why are LGBT plus people perceived to be immoral heathens in those countries? It's because those countries are governed by assholes. The people in charge have the power to change the perception of LGBT plus people in their countries, but they don't. Instead, they actively ask for LGBT plus people to be outed, to be imprisoned, to be brutalized and raped, or to be killed by their families. You might think there is very little you can do. there is. Research any LGBT plus equal rights charity and support their causes. Research the projects undertaken by the United Nations to support the advancement of LGBT plus equality and inclusion overseas. There's always something you can do to support the voices of the silenced. You've only got one life, so why not live it by being helpful and kind? Until next time.